On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, former Senator Claire McCaskill is joined by fellow political experts and insiders to examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
We have emerged with the teacher, the coach, the veteran, the governor, Tim Walz. I always think it's better to have somebody on the ticket that has actually won in a state that's hard.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts and follow. New episodes every Thursday.
Mpox has been around since the 1970s in West and Central Africa, but never like this.
This clade 1B, as we call it, is much more transmissible, and it's causing severe disease, and particularly in children.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The U.S. sells weapons to lots of countries. Some turn those weapons on civilians.
We are hemorrhaging diplomatic credibility, not just in the region, but throughout the world.
Also, lost love, the relationships between Spanish women and Moroccan men that were once illegal, plus imitation elephants coming soon to a large open space near you.
We have about 50 life-size, anatomically perfect recreations of real wild elephants sort of meandering along.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today.
Scientists are rushing to understand the new Mpox strain that is spreading out from the Democratic Republic of Congo. They're concerned that it's changing fast, and they don't have the resources to properly track it. Cases of Mpox have been identified in at least 18 countries in Africa.
And yet, the first Mpox vaccines are only just arriving on the continent this week. Dr. Helen Reese co-chairs the team overseeing South Africa's response to Mpox. We reached her in Johannesburg.
Mpox has been around for a long time, since the 1970s in both Central Africa and West Africa. But in recent years, we've seen a change in the way it has spread. And what we now have in the Democratic Republic of Congo is an Mpox, what we call a clade, which has changed, and it's now called a clade 1B. And the spread before this was jumping from animal reservoirs into humans and into households through contact, and then it would just peter out. What we've seen now is that this clade 1B, as we call it, is much more transmissible. It means it spreads more easily, and it's causing severe disease, and particularly in children. But we've also seen a change in that it's being spread through heterosexual contact and spread to other African countries, but also just a few cases of global spread as well.
And how many cases have been documented so far in the DRC?
So documented, we think we've got about 20,000 cases and over 500 deaths. About 80% of those deaths are in children under 15. But the problem is that the area in the DRC that's the worst affected is also in a conflict zone. There are many internally displaced people living in very poor conditions in camps. So it's difficult to know how many cases are being recorded versus how many cases are being missed, simply because surveillance is difficult.
An Mpox vaccine has been available in places like the U.S. since 2022, when there was an outbreak here. But I understand that countries in Africa are only getting their first vaccines this week. Is that right?
That's correct. So there are two vaccines that have been recommended by the World Health Organization. And one of the vaccines in particular was widely used globally in the big 2022 outbreak of Mpox, which I'm sure many people in the US will remember.
Sure.
This was an outbreak that occurred mostly in the gay and bisexual community with about 100,000 cases. But vaccines got out very quickly and were shown to be about 85% effective. So an effective vaccine response in that community. In addition, many of the richer countries that were affected by that outbreak now have stockpiles with tens of thousands and if not millions of vaccines stockpiled in case they see a resurgence within their own countries. Unfortunately, we have been waiting for some time. The DRC, this outbreak has grown and grown and spread to neighboring countries. South Africa has an outbreak. We are still waiting to get those vaccines.
There are echoes of the COVID pandemic here, vaccines not getting to places where they're needed most, especially poorer countries. What does this tell us about lessons learned or not learned by the global health community about vaccine access?
Yeah, so it's such a good question. And you're quite right. I mean, even today, if we looked at a map of the world and we looked at who's had COVID vaccines per 100,000 population, Africa would be colored very light because we've had the least coverage of even COVID vaccines. The vaccines came to the region late and were distributed late. And by the time we got them, once again, richer countries had stockpiles. This is just counterintuitive. If we know that we have a pathogen that is already spreading within the African region, we should immediately say, well, the world is then at risk, because anything in one part of the world, as we all know too well from COVID, can spread to another part of the world.
What about the goal of having vaccines actually produced in Africa? How close are we to that goal?
Well, this was a very, very strong demand that came from the African Union after the COVID-19 pandemic. So there's now a very big ambition from the African Union and the African CDC and from WHO to get manufacturing sites up and running. And that has begun. But that's medium term. That's not going to address the immediate crisis. But certainly in the medium term, we really do need to build up the capacity, because otherwise this pattern of non-access and other countries wanting to protect their own citizens and therefore not sharing stockpiles, that pattern is likely to be repeated unless we start to have local manufacturing.
Dr. Helen Rees is a professor at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, and she co-chairs the team overseeing South Africa's response to Mpox.
At least 30 people are dead and many more are missing in eastern Sudan following the collapse of the Arbat Dam. Torrential rain earlier in the week caused a surge in floodwaters leading to the dam's collapse. This comes as Sudan marks 500 days of war today. Between that war and natural disasters, Sudan has suffered massive losses to both life and infrastructure recently. Mathilde Vu is a Sudan advocacy manager with the Norwegian Refugee Council. She's in Port Sudan, just 25 miles south of the collapsed dam.
The issue of the dam is extremely concerning. Actually, it's very difficult to get information about it because the floods have also cut down telecommunication infrastructures across the state and in parts of the east of the country. It will have consequences on people's ability to access clean water in the state of the Red Sea. And that is extremely concerning because the states where I'm sitting right now is a place where hundreds of thousands of people have fled to. This is what I call like a refuge state.
Yeah, so Mathilde, talk more about that because, I mean, as I said, the dam is not that far from Port Sudan, as you just explained. I mean, it's become a base for the government, diplomats, aid agencies. What does this dam collapse mean for the daily functioning of Port Sudan?
At the moment, we don't see the actual impact of the dam collapse, but it is going to happen in the coming days. What we know is that humanitarian organizations are looking at ways also to support the people who are going to flee. But you know how many roads across Sudan right now are being flooded? There's bridges in Darfur that have collapsed because of the floods. And this is really key for people to move, for transporters to transport food, for humanitarian assistance to reach people in need in the most remote places.
Specifically, what has the war done to civilian infrastructure? And are there other major assets like this dam that are now at risk?
The war has destroyed infrastructures basically all in major cities. Looking at, for example, even Khartoum, the capital, has been massively destroyed. We're looking at bridges and roads, but also hospitals, telecommunication. You know that half of the country right now is offline. We are seeing right now a cholera outbreak in some states of the country. One of the reasons is because also, yes, the flood, but also the water and sanitation system has been completely affected by urban warfare. The warring parties basically just disregarding international humanitarian law and not, you know, taking the measures to actually protect any of these infrastructures.
It's a miserable situation after 500 days of war. Millions of people are food insecure, but what is your assessment of the current humanitarian situation and what is the level of urgency?
It's catastrophic. You have half of the population right now, 25 million, who are hungry. This is literally the world's largest food crisis. And just the basics, 10 million people displaced, I mean, 10 million people who have just lost their job and so therefore earn a living and so therefore afford eating. So famine was actually confirmed in one of the displaced camps of Darfur. And it's really, really a tragedy to see that right now in some places of Darfur, children are dying every day because of hunger.
In Port Sudan, what's the mood of ordinary Sudanese you've met as this war continues? Oh, and then, by the way, we hear about this dam collapse.
People feel abandoned by the international community. This is something that is very, very clear. Port Sudan is sort of the last place. There's nowhere else to flee. The living conditions in the city are very difficult. Every single item on the market has triple prices. And obviously, you know, the doors for Sudanese refugees are not open. So people feel stuck. There's still appetite for resilience. And you see here and there in the streets of Port Sudan, some of the businesses and restaurants and so on that you were familiar with back in Khartoum. And it shows that there is a desire for, you know, for life and for going on. But I think it's in the head of many that this can be temporary and that war is at the door, like everything else, war, disease, economic crisis, hardship. It's just that, again, there's nowhere to flee.
Mathilde Vu is a Sudan advocacy manager with the Norwegian Refugee Council. She joined us from Port Sudan.
The Cliff Walk in Newport, Rhode Island has been a tourist attraction for decades. You've got the ocean on one side of the path and on the other, sprawling Gilded Age mansions with vast lawns. But now there is something new to see along the route. The world's Bianca Hillier paid a visit.
Ruth Ganesh beams with pride as she looks onto one of those oceanside lawns along the cliff walk. There sits much more than patio furniture.
We have about 50 life-size, anatomically perfect recreations of real wild elephants in sculptural form, sort of meandering along.
Ganesh is the co-founder of a project called The Great Elephant Migration. It's a traveling art exhibition of 100 elephant sculptures that were made by indigenous artists across southern India. Each sculpture takes a team of 10 people, a few months to build. They look like they're made of bamboo sticks that follow along the animal's natural curves.
What a baby! Baby!
On a hot afternoon, dozens of kids and adults alike admire the elephants. You're allowed to touch them, just no climbing or pulling the tails.
As soon as walking in, it was like, wow, it's gorgeous.
That's art, right? It gives you, you can feel it. It gives you emotion, right?
Estrella and Mark Ventura came from a few towns over to see the exhibit. For a young girl named Aviana, the sculptures are inspiring.
I want to go into the real elephant.
Real elephants, the ones that make the fun noise, she adds. The herd is meant to make people smile, Ruth Ganesh says, but it also comes with a message.
Human race share space. They are inspiring human beings to imagine a world where you have wild animals roaming around very close by, and what a magical version of the world that is.
People across the world, including in India, do a remarkable job of coexisting with elephants, says Tosh Takekara, a researcher involved with the project. He's based in the Nilgiri Hills in South India.
The key to coexistence in some sense is to share space across time. Like in the night, when people are not active, the elephants become more active.
Elephants come close to houses at night and are mostly peaceful. Takekara says this coexistence is being threatened, though, by the very material the great elephant migration sculptures are made out of, an invasive species called lantana.
It's toxic, so no animals can eat it. Because nothing can eat it, it completely takes over and displaces all the native vegetation. So there's nothing left for native animals to eat.
That forces animals, including elephants, out of the forests and into more conflict with people. They eat crops, damage homes, and can be violent. Producing these sculptures not only draws awareness to this issue, but it makes a direct positive impact by removing the invasive plants and leaving wildlife with more space to roam. Takekara says that's what people in South India want.
Elephants are considered a god. It's one of the gods that is worshipped across India.
Locals even name the ones in their town, and each sculpture is designed to match a real elephant, says Ruth Ganesh.
They're all named, known, loved by those indigenous groups, and I think that's what makes it different and special.
Next week, the herd will make its way to New York City before heading on to Florida, Wyoming, Montana, and California over the next year. Visitors can also take one home for between $8,000 and $22,000.
We're in a bubble bath of elephant sales.
Really?
We have sold 100 elephants.
The proceeds go toward conservation efforts. As they're sold, the artists back in India continue building new elephants so that a full herd can continue the migration. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Newport, Rhode Island.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Israeli military has ordered people in central Gaza to leave the area. Dozens of patients, including premature babies, evacuated yesterday from one of the last functioning hospitals in the territory. The civilian death toll in Gaza is rising, and so is the scrutiny on weapons the U.S. is supplying for the fighting. America is the largest supplier of weapons to Israel. In the past 2 weeks alone, Washington announced the sale of an additional $20 billion of hardware to its ally. The U.S. also sends arms to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Ukraine. Now, activists and former U.S. government officials are raising alarms about possible human rights violations. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
After a recent Israeli airstrike on a school in central Gaza, an eyewitness video appeared online. A boy who looks like maybe he's around 12 years old is picking up shards of metal from the ground. Behind him, the aftermath of the strike is visible. There are mattresses, clothes, and a fan belonging to displaced people who had sheltered at the school. Look at these fragments, the boy says. This one cut a girl in half. Two munition experts later told CNN that the boy was holding fragments of American-made weapons. That attack on August 10 left dozens of people dead, including children, according to the United Nations. The Israeli military said it targeted a Hamas hideout. We are unable to verify the details independently because the Israeli military only gives access to Gaza to international journalists who are embedded with the military. Shortly after the attack at the school, the Biden administration announced plans to send another $20 billion worth of military equipment to Israel. Tanks, fighter jets, and medium-range missiles are on the list. Most of this won't be delivered for a few years, but the announcement has outraged activists. Nathan Fuller is the executive director of the Courage Foundation.
We're saying enough. We can't let that continue.
Fuller helped organize a letter campaign demanding that the Biden administration stop arming Israel. Over 100 journalists signed the letter. Fellow organizer Chip Gibbons is a policy director for an NGO called Defending Rights and Dissent, which advocates for civil rights.
One of the goals of this letter is to show that people who are concerned with press freedom, journalists and media organizations, support an arms embargo because we cannot be silent when American weapons are used to kill Palestinian journalists.
The impact of the U.S. weapons on the ground goes beyond a specific group. American healthcare workers who have volunteered in Gaza have also joined the call to stop arms shipment to Israel. Dr. Ahmed Youssef returned from Gaza about 3 weeks ago. Last week, he spoke at a news conference on the sidelines of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
The reason I lose sleep and the reason we cry tears isn't sadness anymore. It's a feeling that we have no power to stop the bleeding.
Youssef told the story of a young pregnant woman he had treated. He said she'd been rushed to the hospital with severe injuries after her home was bombed. She and her baby didn't survive, Youssef said.
She was no fighter. She was a pregnant woman who was sitting in her home when a bomb dropped on her head.
The Israeli military tells me it is committed to mitigating civilian harm and that it's putting more effort and resources into getting information about targets ahead of strikes. The military also tells me that it must weigh the expected military advantage against the, quote, likely collateral civilian harm. Still, the Biden administration says more should be done. Here's Vice President Kamala Harris speaking with reporters about the school attack earlier this month.
Yet again, there are far too many civilians who have been killed. I mean, Israel has a right to go after the terrorists that are Hamas. But as I have said many, many times, they also have, I believe, an important responsibility to avoid civilian casualties.
The U.S. does have laws that ensure its weapons are not harming civilians. The Leahy Law, for example, bans the U.S. from helping any unit of a foreign security force that commits gross violations of human rights. But the implementation has been patchy, says Charles Blaha, former director of the State Department's Office of Security and Human Rights.
Unfortunately, it's very, very discouraging. We haven't seen the State Department take any concrete action with regard to arms transfers to Israel or with regard to Israeli units that are credibly involved in gross violation of human rights.
Blaha says complaints from human rights groups about how Saudi Arabia was using U.S. weapons in Yemen led to the creation of a new program at the State Department called Civilian Harm Incident Response Guidance, or CHIRC in short. It's been in place since last August.
Under that mechanism, officials from the State Department and from the Department of Defense consider allegations that U.S. origin arms have resulted in civilian harm.
The Biden administration paused sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, but it recently reversed it. Blaha says the CHIRC mechanism is a good start, but the process is opaque and that the State Department doesn't hold all the recipients of U.S. arms to the same standard.
I think it's due to fear of criticism from Israel and fear of domestic critics.
And this is costing the U.S., he says.
These types of actions or inactions have consequences. We are hemorrhaging diplomatic credibility, not just in the region, but throughout the world.
The State Department tells me that it is looking into reports of misuse of American weapons and that it seeks more information about specific incidents brought to its attention. Anil Sheeline, former State Department employee, says this is not only about international credibility.
One specific risk for the United States is to be potentially liable for war crimes.
Sheeline resigned from her position at the State Department last March in protest over the Biden administration's handling of the war in Gaza. Both Sheeline and Blaha are concerned about how U.S. weapons are used elsewhere, in Ukraine, for example. But they say that in Ukraine, there's a lot more transparency. Plus, they say, so far it seems that Ukraine has mainly been using them against Russian military targets. During his speech to the Congress last month, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the case that Israel's military needs more weapons. He said that his nation is facing threats from not just Hamas in Gaza, but also from the Houthis in Yemen, Iran, and Hezbollah in Lebanon.
And as we defend ourselves on all fronts, I know that America has our back, and I thank you for it.
Paul O'Brien, executive director of Amnesty International USA, says his organization has submitted evidence to the State Department that show U.S. weapons are harming civilians in Gaza.
From what our research shows, these were attacks on civilians and civilian objects, and under human rights law, need to be investigated as war crimes.
He says Amnesty has also documented civilian harm caused by Hamas in Israel. He describes the U.S.'s weapons sales as a failure of diplomacy.
When it has to resort to putting weapons of death in the hands of its allies, it means that it has failed to achieve what it states are its core foreign policy goals, which is to advance human rights and to ensure the conflicts can be resolved peacefully.
The U.S. has been pursuing a ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel for months. So far, there's been no breakthrough. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You're listening to The World. All signs point to Iran wanting to talk with the West about its nuclear program. Political will is one thing. Reaching an agreement is quite another.
The most determining factor here, of course, is the outcome of the U.S. elections. But even then, it's going to be a very tough road ahead.
Also, tea farmers in Japan are calling it quits. That's all ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Mosquito-borne diseases are on the rise in the U.S. In New Hampshire, a man who came down with Eastern Equine Encephalitis, known as Triple E, died today. It was the state's first Triple E infection in a decade. Also in the news this month, Dr. Anthony Fauci said he likely had contracted West Nile virus from a mosquito bite in his backyard. If this is alarming for people in the U.S., it is a daily reality for people living in the tropics. Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He says knocking down mosquito-borne illnesses requires constant vigilance.
You know, the problem is there are multiple different pathogens, illnesses, and multiple different mosquitoes, and you need different approaches for each of them. Approaches include vaccinating individuals against mosquito-borne illnesses. There's a new dengue vaccine. There's a new chikungunya vaccine, which is another virus that's arising, a new malaria vaccine. So that's one approach. New approaches for mosquito control, especially for the Aedes mosquito, spelled A-E-D-E-S, which transmits dengue, Zika, chikungunya, and yellow fever using either genetically modified mosquitoes or using this interesting bacterial agent as a biologic control known as Wolbachia. And of course, educating the public of what we need to do to keep yourself safe when you go outdoors. Unfortunately, in the hot weather, it means really keeping covered with long sleeves, long pants, and putting and applying insect repellent containing DEET to exposed areas.
So you mentioned DEET. That is definitely one thing that people in the United States can do. Anyone who has lived in the tropics, though, knows about sleeping under bed nets. A few years ago, there were these chemically treated bed nets, even more protection against mosquitoes. They were being promoted as a public health measure in tropical countries. How successful are bed nets at preventing illness from mosquito bites?
Well, they've been good for malaria control, and prior to the malaria vaccine, that was one of our mainstays, and we still implement bed nets. And it hasn't been done so much in the U.S. unless you're going camping and are hyper-exposed to be a mainstay just yet. But some of the personal protective measures are going to be important. Let me give you an example. I'm in Houston, Texas, where our state bird is known as the mosquito, and we, you know, have West Nile, and we're at risk for dengue and others. So when I'm getting my 10,000 steps in, I try to do them early in the morning and in the evening when Culex mosquitoes and other mosquitoes are out and about. And I'll wear sweatpants and a hooded sweatshirt and baseball cap and put on DEET insecticide repellent on my dorsal and palmar hands and around my neck. And people look at me like I'm crazy dressed so heavily in the hot weather. But I think it's important, as we've learned from what happened to Dr. Fauci.
How much does climate change contribute to the rise of mosquito-borne illnesses in northern regions?
Nobody can really say, but I think it's a big component. And I sometimes have disagreements with colleagues, and we differ on how much climate change is a factor. I think it's a big factor, and I think it explains a lot of why we're seeing this profound acceleration in vector-borne diseases, both in North and South America, as well as in Central America. Another factor that we don't talk about much is urbanization, because the Aedes mosquitoes are urban-dwelling mosquitoes. And when you go into low-income neighborhoods in many parts of the United States, especially here on the Gulf Coast, you can see poor quality housing without window screens or air conditionings, which are great for mosquitoes. Mm. But the other big one is the dumping of car and truck tires,
right,
in poor neighborhoods, a lot of tire dumping. And those tires are what I call the Ritz-Carlton Hotel for the Aedes aegypti mosquito, especially when there's a little bit of water in them. And so we need to be more vigilant about preventing tire dumping, especially in poor neighborhoods.
Briefly, Peter, what is it about mosquito biology that makes them able to carry such an array of diseases and spread them to humans?
They are so well adapted to human blood feeding that all of these pathogens through evolution have figured out, hey, this is a really great conduit to infect mammalian hosts. And the mosquito is so well highly adapted. And now, you know, we're starting to see some of our best scientists in the United States really take a hard look at mosquitoes, and we're learning so much about the subtlety of different mosquito species, how they recognize human hosts versus other mammalian hosts, what the triggers are that cause them to be attracted. It's some of the most fascinating science going on right now.
Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
We recently reported on Germans picking up the taste of alcohol-free beer. The Irish are apparently doing the same. Alcohol consumption in Ireland has dropped nearly a third in the past 20 years, according to an industry survey. The Irish Examiner reports that people are drinking less alcohol overall and turning more to low and no alcohol beverages.
Condolences to a zoo in Krefeld, Germany, where Jan the Sloth has passed away. At 54 years of age, Jan was considered the oldest sloth in the world. The zoo said it was difficult for his keepers to say goodbye to him. Some of them had cared for Jan for more than two decades.
Let me provide the antidote with happier German zoo news. Baby pandas, twins. At just 5 days old, they're deaf, blind, pink, and weigh less than half a pound. That is normal. The Berlin Zoo is cautiously optimistic about their survival. Giant pandas typically only have one cub at a time, so the zoo is swapping the twins between their mom and an incubator. Experts from China's Chengdu research base of giant panda breeding have joined the team in Berlin to boost the baby panda's chances.
And that's a few things you might have missed. When the supreme leader of Iran speaks in public, even seemingly vague remarks can be loaded with meaning. Speaking to Iran's civilian government today, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei suggested that there was no barrier to engaging with Iran's enemy. It's thought he was referring to the United States and the West, and offering tacit permission for negotiations over Iran's rapidly advancing nuclear program. Ali Vaez directs the Iran project at the International Crisis Group. He says there are good reasons to conclude the comments were about nuclear negotiations.
Because of the economic situation in Iran, which is truly in dire straits, the Iranian leadership has realized that without at least a degree of economic reprieve through sanctions relief, they are not going to be able to put the economy on the right track. And that's why they're interested in negotiating with the U.S. and finding a way to lift the sanctions.
And so do you think this is an appropriate interpretation of these comments, that they are, offering this tacit permission for nuclear negotiations?
Yeah, look, there are more than just one signal to look at. The newly elected Iranian president who took office, President Pezeshkian, he came to office on the promise of coming back to the nuclear negotiations with the U.S. and with the West. He even said it doesn't make sense for Iran not to negotiate with the U.S. directly and use intermediaries who put their own interests first. There's also the fact that his newly appointed foreign minister is the man who negotiated the 2015 nuclear deal. And now we have the supreme leader saying that it is fine to engage with Iran's adversaries. And so we put all of them together. It really signals that Iran is prepared for negotiations.
You mentioned, of course, the Iranian economy as a driver of this willingness to come to the table for nuclear negotiations. Why is that so important to fix right now at this moment?
The Iranian economy has not only suffered from low growth, but it has also suffered from very high inflation and unemployment rates. The currency has lost a lot of value. The population is growing, and that has resulted in frequent and quite violent upheavals that the regime has resorted to brute force to suppress. And they know that through suppression, they've not really addressed the underlying grievances, and they've only bought time until the next confrontation between the state and the society. I think they have now acknowledged that without some sanctions relief from the U.S., they're not going to be able to fix their economy.
Ali, did you say that the population is growing and that is part of why there's increased pressure?
Yes, of course. It's a country of 85 million with nearly 50% unemployment rate for the youth. And that's just a ticking bomb for any society, especially a society like Iran, in which there is a whole host of reasons for discontent, including social restrictions, also isolation from the outside world.
How will who wins the White House in November impact any kind of prospective nuclear deal with Iran?
We might be facing two fundamentally different scenarios. I think in a Harris administration, there will be the political will to find a solution to this nuclear standoff. But there is a lot of mistrust between the two sides. The nuclear program has made advancements that are really irreversible, and U.S. sanctions have also proliferated. And the U.S. has proven unable to provide Iran with effective and sustainable sanctions relief. So you put all of that together, the same solution that was used in 2015 is no longer valid, and a new formula has to be found with the time pressure of October 2025, which is when the resolution that endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal will expire, and with it, the West's last leverage to hold Iran's nuclear file at the UN Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the Trump presidency, there's literally bad blood between Iran and President Trump, because he ordered the assassination of the top Iranian general, General Soleimani, as well as the fact that he's the president who got out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran and created all of this mistrust between the two countries.
And meanwhile, of course, there's the war in Gaza and rising regional tensions. How will that play into any nuclear negotiations? It seems like it could be a complicating factor.
The context has changed a lot. In the period leading up to the 2015 nuclear deal, the parties were able to compartmentalize their differences. Even if they were on the opposite sides of the civil war in Syria or in Yemen, they could still negotiate. But now everything is interlinked. And of course, if the war in Gaza leads to a regional conflagration in which the U.S. and Iran could also end up in a direct military conflict, it would make reaching a nuclear agreement so much more difficult, if not impossible, because if, of course, there is a military strike on Iranian soil, given the proximity that the Iranians now have to nuclear weapons, they might even consider taking the last step and weaponizing their nuclear program to use it as the ultimate deterrent.
Ali Vaez is the director of the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group.
Imagine writing tender love letters to your sweetheart overseas, only to have them confiscated by censors whose sole job was to end your relationship. In Spain, under the dictatorship of Francisco Franco, that happened to hundreds of Spanish women who, from the 1930s to the 1950s, were writing letters to their boyfriends in Morocco. The World's Jerry Haddon first reported this story from Barcelona last summer.
This is a letter written by a young Spanish bookseller named Carmen. She wrote it to her Moroccan love in 1948.
Querido Abdel Latif, no sé cómo empezar esta carta.
My beloved Abdel Latif, I don't know where to start this letter. Your return would never be too late, because my heart is yours and yours alone.
Mis ojos, los que tú decías que no querías que derramasen ni una lágrima.
Life here is bereft of joy and laughter. My eyes, which you said you hoped would never shed tears, are soaked with them. My nights are a torment. I see thousands of images of you, like ghosts, causing me to toss and turn and awake suddenly with my arms thrown open.
Carmen mailed the letter from Barcelona to Tetuan, the capital of what was then Spain's Moroccan protectorate. Spain had a colonial presence in Morocco from 1912 until 1956. Carmen met Abdel Latif when he was studying in Spain. He'd gone home, and this letter never reached him. Spanish censors in Morocco had seized it and opened an investigation. This is from their report.
Abdel Latif is a hypocrite and a con man. He's also a fervent Moroccan nationalist. Our suggestion? Deny him re-entry onto the Spanish mainland and prohibit Carmen from coming here.
The report and the letter languished for decades in Spain's national archives until a couple of years ago when researchers found them.
So you open these boxes and each had tons and tons of small envelopes. In total, there's, I think, 700 of them.
Arthur Aseraf is an associate professor of history at Cambridge University. He'd been poking around the archives on another subject when he stumbled on the trove.
And each envelope is a little file on a person, and there's so much stuff. You know, there's pictures, there's these handwritten letters, sometimes there's other documents, and there's all of these surveillance reports by the authorities.
With the goal, Aseraf says, of keeping Spanish women out of the arms of Moroccan men. Like chaperones at the prom, except then they follow you home, Gestapo style.
The worry is that a white woman in a relationship with a colonized man will look bad for colonial authority. It will undermine the prestige of the colonizing power. Because, and you have to sort of put yourself in the mindset at the time, women are inferior to men. So a white woman in a relationship with a non-white man will end up being subservient to that man.
which turns colonial power on its head. In other words, how can I possibly control you if you're controlling my women?
Ben Ali, ¿cómo olvidar aquellos dulces momentos cuando por el paseo de las palmeras me dijiste que me amabas?
Ben Ali, how to forget that sweet moment when strolling under the palm trees you told me that you loved me. Your words seemed unreal, yet in my soul they echoed sweetly. My lips still tremble from your last kiss. The light from your green eyes has cast a spell on me.
This letter is from Maria, written and intercepted in 1938. The romantic spell she professes to be under wasn't just a political threat to Spain, says Aseraf. It was existential.
A Spanish woman who would marry a Moroccan man would be lost to the Catholic faith. And under the Franco regime, the regime sort of sees itself as defending the Catholic faith.
The Spanish censor's notes reveal deeply ingrained misogyny. Here's one from 1938 from the file of a woman named Concha, who'd fallen in love with a Moroccan soldier named Nassar.
Concha, at 50 years old, is ugly, fat as a hippo, and slightly lame. Among her good qualities, she owns a house in Salamanca's main square. That must be what's awoken Nassar's volcanic love for her.
The reports and the letters go on and on over a period of about 20 years, until 1956, when Morocco gained independence. The Spanish women came from all walks of life, maids, clerks, cabaret dancers, students. Some got pregnant with their Moroccan lovers, some even married them. But still, authorities did their best to keep them apart.
There's something about their complete disregard for these people involved and what they managed to make look like a threat. You know, like, this woman wrote a letter which has no particularly sensitive content, and they're like, this is extremely dangerous. This woman must be banned. Is insane.
Insane, says Aseraf, yet a common tactic throughout European colonialism. Looking into these archives, you see how the authorities were able to keep people physically apart, but they could never censor what people felt.
Ya sabes que este y mi alma te pertenecen. ¿Hasta cuándo seguiré sufriendo?
You well know that my heart and soul belong to you. How long must I go on suffering? I am eternally yours.
This is another letter from Maria to Ben Ali. At the very bottom, she wrote, I love you, 43 times in a row.
Te quiero, te quiero, te quiero.
Then, to make her point, and you could just imagine her fingers starting to cramp, she added after the last I love you, simply, to infinity.
Hasta el infinito te quiero.
For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon in Barcelona.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Green tea is a major industry in Shizuoka Prefecture on Japan's Pacific coast. More than a third of the tea leaves produced in Japan come from this region. Shizuoka is picturesque. Hillsides covered in neat rows of bright green tea bushes, Mount Fuji in the background. That scenery is changing, though. Reporter Hannah Kirshner headed to Shizuoka to find out why so many tea farmers are throwing in the towel.
When I arrive at the farm stay where I'll spend my first night in Shizuoka, a bulldozer is ripping out tea bushes. My host, Yoko Miyake, tells me her husband farmed tea until about 15 years ago. After her husband passed away, she leased the fields to another farmer. This spring, that farmer called it quits, too. The wholesale price of tea leaves went even lower this year. She says it's better to get out. Miyake is clearing away tea bushes to make way for a patio, where her guests can enjoy a cookout or drink a cup of tea. On a walk around the neighborhood, I see some tidy, active tea fields, and right next to them, wild, overgrown, neglected fields. I meet a retired farmer in his 90s. He points towards his tea fields way up on the mountainside. His tenant quit farming, too. Everyone is ending their leases, he tells me. It's a big problem. The fields are no longer a good source of income, and when they're neglected, they become an eyesore. My guide on this walk is Satoshi Nihonyanagi. He arranged my homestay, too.
So what I do is to help local elderly people to sustain their own lives by tourism.
For the 30 or 40 farmers he works with, hosting guests like me is a way to make a little extra income, especially now that it's become so difficult to make a living growing tea. Nihon Yanagi explains that the tea market has very specific economics. Most farmers pool their leaves with a local cooperative and sell them at auction. Buyers do the final processing and packaging. Tea can be harvested 4 times a year: spring, early summer, late summer, and autumn. Nihon Yanagi writes these down and draws a line.
So he basically just drew a downward slope from the first harvest to the last harvest.
Every spring, the earliest tea harvested in all of Japan fetches the highest price at auction. And from there, the price just falls. Shizuoka has a relatively late first harvest. And on the tea market, that puts the region at a disadvantage.
This region is, you know, surrounded by mountains, so they don't have enough sunshine.
And it has nothing to do with the taste of the tea, because the tea that gets some shade actually tastes better, right?
Much better, yes.
Shizuoka specializes in a style of green tea called sencha. If you buy a bottle of Japanese green tea from a vending machine or convenience store, that's usually sencha. That mass-produced bottled tea was introduced in the 90s, and it changed the tea industry. Overall tea consumption in Japan is actually pretty steady, but year by year, bottled tea consumption is overtaking the kind of tea you brew yourself.
I've heard people say that young people don't know how to brew tea. Do you think it's
right,
true?
That's right.
Because they only ever drank tea from a plastic bottle.
Yes, that's right.
The popular bottled tea company Itoen buys about a quarter of all the leaves that go to auction. Nihon Yanagi tells me that these bottled tea companies buy the autumn harvest, when the price is lowest. That's why a lot of older farmers are giving up on tea altogether. But some young farmers have a different idea. They're trying to create an alternative tea market by selling directly to consumers. They stand out by making organic or naturally farmed tea, tea that expresses a sense of place, or black tea. In another mountain village, about an hour away, I meet Hiroki Hojo, president of Green 8 Tea Company. Hojo is 44, young in this industry. He took over tea farming from his father. I think the industry has a chance to change, Hojo tells me. We're sitting in the cafe attached to his tea factory, where you can get a black tea-flavored ice cream parfait or shaved ice. Green 8 specializes in a product Hojo calls not bitter black tea. Since everyone was aiming for the kind of black tea you drink with milk and sugar, we thought we'd go the other way, says Hojo. I sip a cup of his plain black tea.
Yeah, it's not bitter at all. It has a very gentle taste.
They still make green tea too, but Hojo says it's tough to get new customers with just green tea. Green 8 has been marketing their black tea for 12 years now. They recently opened a second cafe and shop in Shizuoka Station, a big bustling train station. But Hojo says this isn't a success story yet. He hopes someone will want to take over his business one day, keep growing tea, and keep innovating. That's his definition of success. In a tea field nearby, Green 8 has a spot to snap photos.
Okay, and then there's this little platform in the middle of the tea field and some stumps you can sit on and pose. Oh, actually, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
You can see down into the valley and these steep mountains behind it.
If Green 8 and small companies like it succeed, maybe you'll still be able to see this kind of scenery a generation from now. For the world, I'm Hannah Kirshner, in the tea fields of Shizuoka, Japan.
How many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting high?
They are getting the band back together. If Wonderwall or this song, Champagne Supernova, were part of your essential 90s soundtrack, then you may already be thinking about tickets for the Oasis reunion tour.
The Britpop brothers Liam and Noel Gallagher broke the band up 15 years ago during a notorious feud that left the siblings not speaking for years. Today, Oasis said, this is it, this is happening, the guns have fallen silent, in their announcement of 14 concert dates in the British Isles next summer.
So go dust off your CD cases, and as they've said, don't look back in anger. A champagne supernova in the sky.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you back here tomorrow.